Hey, hi, I'm Dove. I'm a sexaholic, and I'm grateful to got to people like you who want sobriety and are willing to do something real about it for a change, and because that's why there was a meeting there for me when I needed one, starting on February 28th, 1997, and because I came to see that I'm powerless over lust. I can't control lust. It just controls me, and that's it. I just need freedom from lust because it's killing me. It's just making me meshuggah. And thank God there's a program that the alcoholics gave us, and here we are. So I'm going to express my gratitude to the Rabbanu Shalom for that. And who did he make that? Who did he create this meeting for and this Alcoholics Anonymous for and the 12 steps but drunks like me, sex drunks, you know? That's who he created SA and AA for, you know, AA ultimately and then eventually SA for professional, hidden, secret, religious fakers, masturbators, porn lovers, people who really love porn, even though they hate to admit that, but they demonstrate their love just the way that the Rabbanu Shalom wants us to demonstrate our love to him. How does he want us to demonstrate our love to him? The Gemara says, the Feresh, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha. It's Gemara in Brachos. How do you love Hashem? How does Hashem, he gives us instructions how to love him. B'chol levavcha. Okay. That means with, as the Maharal says, with all your attention. That's what the Maharal touches the word levav, lave. Lave is tim lave, means pay attention. B'chol levavcha, with all your heart. In other words, all your attention. You've got all your attention, as Victor Miller says constantly. So what did I do, in my addiction? What I do in my addiction is I give my addiction all my attention, whether it's through struggling with porn and masturbating myself, or sex with my wife, or sex with others, massage parlors, prostitutes, exhibitionism, voyeurism, etc., you know, and dirty videos, etc., sex, in other words, you know, and lust, erotica, you know, whether it's through giving my attention to that, or whether it's giving my attention to fighting all that by coming on Guard Your Eyes and making a campaign and a crusade against lust and the internet and porn and Nachshavas Ra'os, have that take my entire attention. Same problem, okay? Same problem. I'm still a twisted trefa creature that's thinking about his penis all day. It's just that I'm thinking about controlling my penis all day or controlling women's images all day and not taking them in and fighting it. You know, fighting it ends up, what the Kutzker says, if you wrestle with a man covered with mud, even if you win the match, you're covered with mud in the end. So, anyway, I need to surrender lust, you know, surrender lust. By the way, I heard a news item that father, and let this be a chus to his family and to him, that father of the seven children, Rahmo and so on, who were killed in the fire, who died in the fire in Brooklyn yesterday, the day before, they were buried in Eretz Yisrael today, and that father was quoted on the news. I assume that it was a part of the recording of his hesped for you know his children. How can you be maspid, you know, your children? He's being maspid, you know, his life. You know, I mean, and here he is being maspid his life. What does he say? He says, how much closer can you get to being maspid yourself than being maspid? God forbid, lo aleinu, your own children. You know, what does he say in his hesped? I heard it on the news on the top of the hour at 11 o'clock or whatever. He said, because I'm sick at home today. He said, he was like loud, saying this out loud, in Eretz Yisrael, I presume. The only way to survive something like this is by complete and utter surrender. Those were his exact words, if I'm not mistaken. Complete and utter surrender is the only way to accept this and go on. The loss of his seven children. That's what he said. You know? He's not a Christian. He's a Fremen. It's just a son. Don't you give him an achama, which is, I don't understand that. Only God can give an achama for somebody who lost 7 children. Only God can keep me sober, you know? I mean, only God can make it so that my life actually, so that I actually stay sober. Only God, I mean, only surrender. Surrender is the only answer. Some guy chatted, you know, to me. I missed him. I was on the Guard Your Eyes forum. I had it up on my computer today. And I saw that he chatted with me, one of these, you know, guys, whatever. I'm not going to say his username because on Guard Your Eyes, saying username is like saying his real name, Lashon Hara or something. He said, I can't imagine living life without lust, you know, without porn and acting out. I just can't imagine that. Cannot imagine it. You know, can't be masochistic. Can't accept it at all, you know. So, that's exactly the problem. How can this father accept living walking around, existing, breathing, eating, after losing his 7 children? You know, in such a fashion, especially. You know, knowing that he didn't have working smoke detectors in his house. He didn't put in working smoke detectors in his house. They obviously didn't have an escape plan. You know, they didn't take measures. How do you live with yourself after that? How is it possible? You know? Besides the fact that the children are gone, Lalina. So he said the only way to move on, is with total, absolute surrender. Those are his words. Surrender to what? Surrender to two things. And this is what surrender in the program is, as far as I'm concerned. Two things. People say, surrender, you're giving up the fight. Chas v'sholem. Torah says we have to fight. Rigzu v'atechato, etc., etc. No. Surrender, that's for normal people. The Torah says rigzu v'atechato, referring to the Yetzer. An addict's issue, if you read the doctor's opinion in AA and Bill's story, where he says that we see in More on Alcoholism, he says, he brings a story from a guy named, I can't remember the guy's name, Bill, Ron, Joe, whatever, about how he was sober for a couple of years, and then he thought, whatever, let me try a little bit of whiskey in my milk, you know, why not? He said that this is cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, it's more cunning than we are, it's more baffling than we can imagine, and it's more powerful than we can than we are if we're sick. And this is not what Chazal mean when they say the Yetzer Hara, you know, Ilmale Ozro Eina Yochalo. This is not what Chazal mean there. They're talking about the regular Yetzer Hara for everything over there. You know, that's qualitatively different. If you wanted to get into that discussion, that's just a debate issue. But I clarified that in the past, thank God. But we can talk about it some other time. But here, surrender means giving up the fight, meaning this is not my fight. This is not my fight, you know. And this father has a fight. What's the fight? To accept the loss that he's got. To accept that loss is a bitter, bitter fight inside the heart of a person. A person does not want to accept such a loss. No, it can't be, it can't be, it can't be. That's what's in the back of the mind. You know, the guilt that maybe he had a part in it in some way by not having fire smoke detectors and this, that his wife's guilt for leaving the bletel on there, the thing on it. Just, and then the loss of the children, Nebuch, you know. How can a person go on, you know? Just like the story I said before about the man who lost his leg, and Rav Noach Weinberg asked him, how are you so happy if you lost your leg? And he said, because I accepted that I am a man with one leg, and that's the way I'm always going to be. When I was 11 years old, when that leg got chopped off, that's what he said. That acceptance is surrender to the truth. He has no more seven children. He has to surrender to the truth. That's surrender, number one. That's huge. And that is what step one is about. Admitted to who? To everyone, that we, including ourselves, that we are powerless over lust and that our lives have become unmanageable, that we lack sanity and that we came to believe that a power greater than us can restore us to sanity. In other words, we don't have sanity. Sobriety isn't the issue. The issue is we're nuts in some respect, truly nuts. Therefore, I have no shame. The only way you know if you really have step one, as far as I'm concerned, is if you can take yourself and go into a meeting with live people. If you're doing it on the phone, you never know. You never know. But the only way, as far as I'm concerned, that you can ever know that you truly accept this is if you can go and admit it in front of real people at an SA meeting or a Guard Your Eyes meeting, a face-to-face meeting. That's the only way I know. Bringing your face and your body without a bag over your head, without taking off your yarmulke, because it's a Chilul Hashem, without changing your name to I Love Lucy or something, you know, or Tshuva 613 or whatever, you know, without changing your name to Sam instead of Shmuel, you know, or Mike instead of Dov, you know, or Michal or something, or Yaakov instead of Michal, or Michal instead of Yaakov, or Shmuel instead of Yitzchak, because it's Shmuel Yitzchak, you know, or if you want the real acceptance, if you want to know if you have it, if you really have that, be yourself and admit to other people that you're sick, you know. Another thing is to go to an AA meeting where there are drug addicts, an alcoholic goyim, and be able to sit in that meeting with your yarmulke on your head, with the payas and the arois, with the tzitzis arois, mitzvah this and mitzvah that, without a bag over your head with two holes, and without changing your name to, you know, whatever, you know, and William, you know, because that's the name on my birth certificate, but that's not the name anyone calls you. That's not your name. As the stipler told me once when I asked him, I had a kasha about my name, Al Pi Halacha, he said to me, whatever your people call you, that's your name, you know, that's your name. So that's what I do in recovery. I say to guys, well, they say, which name should I use? My English name is Bob. My Hebrew name is Baruch. My wife calls me, by my middle name, you know, Yitzchak, and, you know, whatever. Or, you know, so whatever name your wife calls you. You know? Hopefully your wife and your friends call you the same name, so it's a little less complicated. You know what I mean? But anyhow, gotta be real. And if you can sit in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with a bunch of goyim and admit your problem, hi, my name is Yosef, and I'm an addict. You don't have to say you're a sexaholic, because they're not going to understand that. Say, I'm an addict at an AA meeting, at an open AA meeting, not a closed AA meeting. A closed AA meeting is like every SA meeting is a closed meeting. Spouses of SAs are not allowed in an SA meeting, of course. You know, SA meeting is for sexaholics seeking their own sexual sobriety only, as we say in the preamble to every meeting. Unless that group, obviously, you know, elects to make it an open meeting, which I've never seen in my life. But I've been to meetings that were open, but they weren't official SA meetings. And alcoholics have open meetings as well, have open meetings, of course, because in today's society there isn't a stigma about alcoholism like there is about being a pervert, you know. But you go to an AA meeting, you admit exactly who you are, you know, with your face attached and your yarmulke here, and use your Hebrew name as your wife and or friends, family call you, and you say, and I'm an addict just like you, pointing to the, you know, guy sitting there, to the goy sitting there, to the Jew sitting there, to the Yid Neba who's married to a Shiksa. I'm just like you. You're an alcoholic, and I'm a sexaholic. You're a powerless addict. I'm a powerless addict. Tyra can't help me. Tyra can't help you. We're both the same. We need God. You need a spiritual experience in order to stay sober, because everybody can not drink. Everybody can stop. We've stopped thousands of times. You know, like, you don't want to go to a shrink who's a marriage expert, and he has a shingle that says, "I'm a marriage expert. I've been married 84 times. You know, I've been married 6 times. You know, same thing. We're all quitting experts because we've quit 100 times. You know, the program is for people who never really quit forever. We don't know. You know, the one thing we know is that we're powerless and we can't drink today. You know, we can't use lust intentionally today. You know, so that's how you know that you have a first step. If you haven't done that, I believe you don't know if you have a first step yet. So that's all step one and two. Step three, we've spoken about already for 4 calls. I'm not going to go in there, but that's the whole program of recovery is step three. That's it. That's the crux. That's the source. That's the engine that drives it is step one. That's the entire engine. Therefore, you can never forget your first step. You can never forget your insanity. You can never forget your powerlessness. You can never forget that your life is unmanageable by you, by me. I can never forget that. That is the engine that drives any step work that I do for the rest of my life. Admission of powerlessness.
No.
And sex. Just a second. And sexaholism and alcoholism, whatever it is. The first step is the engine that drives everything. You know, and the answer, the response to it is that God can manage my life. I can stop drinking alcohol. I can stop using sex, you know. But I'm going to pick it up after a couple of days because I see that's the way it is with me. I stop hundreds of times. I don't stay stopped, you know. But I can stop. How do I stay stopped? Well, the only way I can stay stopped is by allowing God to manage my life, because I hate my life. There are enough things that I hate my life about, or that I hate about myself, or that I hate about other people, or that I hate about God, or that I hate about everything else, or that I'm angry about in the past, or whatever. There are enough. I have enough pride and character defects, in other words, that I'm never going to be able to stay sober, because a life will never become acceptable to me. I'm always going to eventually have to run to my drug, eventually, because I can't accept life. Sobriety is my problem, not drinking, you know. So therefore, we need step three. Step three is the answer. Now, the problem is, how in the heck do you get step three? We're religious guys, so we should already have a step three. But you see, we don't, you know. So how do you have a faith that actually works instead of just a faith? Having a faith isn't the answer. Having a faith that works is the answer. How do you get a faith that works, you know? You get a faith that works by working step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. You know? That's how you get a faith that works. That's how you get step 3. And again, that's the basic model I'm operating on. And I'm going to be quiet now for Yitzchak or whoever.
Yeah, hi, Doug. I don't think this is original with me, but I'll share it wherever it comes from. Every day we have a mitzvah to remember we left Mitzrayim. One of the 6 remembrances. And the marshal in Torah that most corresponds to recovery that I've ever heard is Mitzrayim. You know, we're stuck. We can't get out. We're getting beaten up. It stinks. At the same time, we kind of like it. We don't want to leave, but we want to leave. We need God to take us out. So if we remember that we left Mitzrayim every day, and we remember what Mitzrayim means to us, to me that's kind of like remembering step one every day.
Right. Because you see, that's true, because you see that the Torah doesn't say only, 50 times it says, I took you out of Mitzrayim. 50 times in the Torah, the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero, what's his sefer again? Whatever it's called, I forget right the second. But in his magnum opus, not Tomer Zavora and the other sefer, that's his magnum opus. He has a whole count of the 50 times, because really it's not 50, it's 52, 54, whatever it is, and he explains how it's not, you know, what, how it's really 50, and the other times they're saying something else. But there's 50 times that it says in the Torah that I took you out of Mitzrayim. 50 times. You know, so, I mean, obviously, God's trying to make a point. But it's not only that. He says, Zecharta ki eved hayisa, you know? And it says about Gerim, by the way, in the Torah. What does it say about Gerim? It says, Ve'ahavta es hager. It says there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to love a ger. And by the way, like I was saying before, which I didn't finish, how does the Torah, what's the Torah's paradigm for love for Hashem, which is paradigm for love for everybody, love always. Love is kol levavcha, with your whole attention, kol nafshecha, even if he takes away your life, right? Kol uvkol me'odecha, and with everything you have, you know? Me'odecha means, you know, b'chol mido mido shu moded l'cha have moded lo mod mod. In other words, with everything you have, everything you've got. Me'od means your money, the Gemara says, api halacha. So the mitzvah to give tzedakah, by the way, or the mitzvah to spend extra on a mitzvah, on doing a mitzvah, or the mitzvah, the source of using your money for Torah education for your children, that's all loving Hashem b'chol me'odecha, with all your money, you know? So, you know, that's how you love Hashem. In other words, with action. That's the point. It doesn't say in the Mishnah, and I brought this to a Rebbe, and I said to him, Ikra chashter min ha-sefer. It says, V'ahavta Hashem akecha b'chol levavcha, meaning either b'shnei yitzarecha, whatever, or with all your attention, which is pashat pshat, and b'chol nafshecha, even on people who know till it's nafshecha, or there's another pshat there too, and nefesh means desire, really. And b'chol me'odecha means with all your abilities, with all your money is the symbol of your wherewithal, of your abilities. That's just a symbol of that, you know. So in other words, it's actions. It's ikra chasim and asefer, I told my Rebbe. It doesn't say love him with all your heart, meaning that you love him, that you feel a feeling of love. And he says to me, and he said to me, that's obvious that loving him in your heart, like you love, like the Rambam says, what's love of Hashem? Love of Hashem, the Rambam uses this crazy-sounding mashal. It's the way you love a woman. That's what the Rambam says. The way you love Hashem is the way you love a woman. How do you love a woman? You think about her all day long. You can't get her out of your mind, and you're crazy over her. That's exactly the lashon the Rambam uses. You know? You know, and many, many guys here have had that experience with their wives or with girlfriends in the past, you know? And the Rambam doesn't care if it's right or wrong. This is just a fact. You fall in love with a woman, she becomes like, that's all you think of, is like, how do I please her? How do I make her love me back? How do I benefit her? You know, like, it's all about her, you know? That's how you love Hashem. That's what the Rambam says. So, and he uses the term meshuga, you know, to be crazy about her, you know, all day long, as it says in the Pasuk. You know, to be crazy about Hashem all day long. Rabbi Victor Miller talks about this extensively. By the way, how do you love Hashem? What does that mean to love Hashem? It means to be nuts about him. Nuts, you know? Which means that he's nuts about us, you know? Which isn't a nice way to say it, but you know what I mean by that. I mean that he's like overtaken, so to speak, with love for us from our point of view. You know what I'm saying? Even though Hashem doesn't have emotions like we do at all, obviously. Even his thoughts aren't like ours. Certainly emotions don't make any sense for him, but that's the idea, that he, you know, he's totally devoted to us with everything that he's got and everything he does. He only does things for us, you know, because he needs nothing, which is what I covered in the third step talk. So b'chol levav, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol medecha are actions. So coming back to the point, so taking action to love, you know, Hashem, that's what loving Hashem is, you know. I lost the exact point that I was making when I started this. There was a particular. It'll come back. So Mitzrayim, Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, and he says, "Ve'ahavtem es hager, love the ger." What does that mean? With action, do things for him, and he gives examples. If the ger is poor, support him. V'ahavtem es hager, v'ger lo sonu. Don't trick a ger, don't cheat a ger, don't hurt his feelings. The Gemara says, when you meet a ger and you're talking with him, you should never, ever, ever bring up, you know, oh, look at the things you used to do. You know what I'm saying? When you were not a yid, because it's he might feel embarrassed. So what does it say? Why? Ve'ahavdim es ager ki gerim hayisem be'eretz Mitzrayim. Because you know the nefesh of a ger, it says. Because you know the nefesh of a ger. You know the feelings of a ger, ki gerim hayisem be'eretz Mitzrayim. Can you imagine how weird that is? That was 1,000 generations ago, you know, that we were gerim in Mitzrayim. Sojourners. What's pshat ger? Ger means that you're a sojourner, you have no family. That's the problem with the ger, that he doesn't have family. He doesn't have Jewish family to take care of him, and therefore he has to take care of him, same as an orphan, same as a widow. You know, she doesn't have a husband to make money for her. You know, make sure you protect her. And Hashem has special protections for a ger, for a widow, and for an orphan, because they don't have anybody to fend for them, Nebuch. Or they might not. You know what I mean? So they're, so see, ki gerim hayisim be'eretz Mitzrayim. Because you were sojourners. You had nobody. You were alone there in the Mitzrim. You know, who was taking care of you? The Mitzrim. That's who was taking care of you. You know? And it says, lo sov the Mitzri. Don't scorn a Mitzri. If a Mitzri wants to convert to Judaism, let him convert to Judaism after so many generations, whatever. Why let him? Because, gerim hayisem ba'artso. Because they fed you, they clothed you, you know, they paid for you, you know, they took care of you, basically, to some extent, while you were there. Crazy stuff. Crazy sounding stuff. But this is all, you know, it's not enough to remember that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, but he says he uses it as direct examples. He gave me yisim ba'artam, you know, et cetera. So you see that's supposed to be an experience that's supposed to affect us all the time. You know what it's like to be needy, because you were needy in Mitzrayim. You had nobody. Huh. How is that supposed to work for us 1,000 generations later? You know, it must be that we're able to see ourselves, which is why the Torah talks about it 50 times. It must be that we're able to access that memory somehow of being powerless, you know, homeless, hopeless. We were hopeless in Mitzrayim. What's Pshat 49th level of Tuma? Hopelessness. We had no hope. Nothing. You know? Amazing. Anyhow, without getting too carried away, I like to, you know, by the Seder, by the way, and through the Mitzrayim thing, I don't see the Yetzias Mitzrayim thing for my own self. I don't see it the way Rabbi Twersky and the way that Yitzchak was just mentioning it exactly, that it refers to the Yetzias Mitzrayim of the Yidden, that Hashem took us out, etc. I don't see it that way. And part of the reason I don't like seeing it that way is because that's something that all Jews can share. So I find it hard to believe that the Torah gives a mitzvah that all the rest of the Jews in the world are supposed to do it the same way that I'm supposed to do it, and understand it the same way I can understand it, but they can't. How can a normal person understand what it's like to be an addict and to be powerless and to fall onto God? How can a normal person understand it? I don't think a normal person can, you know? So I have a hard time accepting that Yetzias Mitzrayim adventure, the focus of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the lesson for us is from the Yidden coming out. I think that lesson has to do with you know, the dependence on Hashem that all Jews, you know, are supposed to have. For me, the lesson of the Mitzrayim story and the Yetzias Mitzrayim is from Paro. You know, if you look at the 10 Makos, it's clear, who did God do the 10 Makos for? For the Jews or for the Mitzrim? The answer is clear, he did it for the Mitzrim, not for the Jews. If he did it for the Jews, then he could have taken us out, it was one Makah. You know? Ella what? He did it for the Mitzrim, you know? This is what it says in, whatever. Anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked again. But he did it for the Mitzrim, which is what he says, Beferish, in the Torah. Hashem says in three places, well, more than three places, but he says it in three different ways, why he's going to do the Mitzrim, why he's playing with the Mitzrim, and hardening Paro's heart, and all this stuff, so that there'll be 10 Makos. He says why? Three ways. One, so that Paro and his family will know, Paro and his house and Mitzrayim will know, Ki Ani Hashem. You know? And the other one is so that Paro and Mitzrayim will know, Ki En Kamoni B'chol Ha'aretz. You know? And the other one is, I can't remember exactly. But anyway, there's three Lashonos where he says, so that they will know that Anochi Hashem Bekerev Ha'aretz, I think, is the third one. That I'm actually here. I'm actually here. I'm not just in the heavens, but I'm here. And it's referring to the Mitzrim knowing this, you know. Another idea that we see where God's concerned about the Goyim, specifically, is with the final Geula. Kigol Rishon Kach Geul Achron. In the final Geula, all over the Nevi'im, it says what? Things like the Naharu Eilecha Kol HaGoyim, you know, that all the nations will come to Yerushalayim. You know, Hashem is going to take the Jews out from everywhere, bring them to Yerushalayim, rebuild the Beis Hamikdash in fire, and the Goyim, and what's the crowning achievement? And the Goyim, all the Goyim of the world will come, stay Goyim, but they're going to come to Yerushalayim, because they don't accept Gerim then. You come to Yerushalayim, and the Naharu Eilecha Kol HaGoyim. All the Goyim are going to be like rivers coming to the center, coming to Yerushalayim, you know? In other words, he's doing it so that in the stones there'll be an awareness of Hashem, you know? Imala Arif Deya Es Hashem Kamayim L'yam Chasim. For everyone, the birds, the stones, everything's going to be obvious that it's Hashem, it's Hashem, it's Hashem, you know? Which, by the way, not a Lubavitcher, but not that there's anything wrong with that. But the Baal HaTanya writes this gorgeous stuff in the Shar Yichud VeEmuna, I think is what it's called, in the back of the Likutei Amoraim. He has this thing about God, the existence of God, the creation of God, and the awareness of God in the Bria. And in the Tanya also, he talks about how, if I'm not mistaken, about how there's Lo'olam Divarcha Hashem Nitzav B'Shamayim. In other words, Hashem's word is in everything. Like the Ramban says in Chumash, that the existence of the table comes from the word Shin Lamed Ches Nun. And those combination of osias gives the table its existence as a table. In other words, God's will is made into a table, you know, by the name of the table. That's the nitzotz that's in the table, and that connection is completely invisible today in this world. And in La'asad Lavo, that connection will be obvious, you know. That connection will be obvious. In other words, we won't see a table anymore. We're only going to see God's will. And we're going to recognize that it's in the form of a table. But we're not going to see a table and try to figure out how it's God's will. It's going to be the opposite. So that's Mala Aretz Deya Es Hashem Kamayim Liyam Chasim. That's for everybody, the Goyim too, you know. So in other words, Yetzias Mitzrayim is for the Mitzrim. It's for Paro, the Goy. So that Paro should know. Why does Hashem care about Paro should know? So the typical way that the average Jew learns it, who's not an addict, is very simple. Because Paro's a Russia, and Hashem wants to show him who's boss. Simple. Just like me, driving down the street, someone cuts me off, I want to show him who's boss. I'm going to drive around, get in front of him, and slow down, call the police on him, and this, I'm going to show him who's boss. And for Hashem, that's glory, that the guy sees, oh, crime doesn't pay, and he's led away with his head hanging low, you know, in shackles with the police, and you know, that's how normal Yid sees it. And there's nothing wrong with that, as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's fine, you know. But I know it's not realistic, because people don't really learn a lesson that way, by being beaten, you know, into submission, and then they admit it, and this, they don't really admit it, you know, typically. But an addict knows exactly what being beaten into submission is. An addict knows that being beaten into submission is the only thing that's going to work, right? What does it say? In the first pasuk of Shari Tshuva, the favorite book, the favorite sefer of all sexaholics, of all from sexaholics, which of course didn't work, which is why they're here, is the beginning of Shari Tshuva. It reads, Tov v'yasher Hashem, al kein yoreh chatzayim baderech. Hashem is good and just, al kein, therefore, yoreh chatzayim baderech. Yoreh means to teach chatzayim, sinners, the way to do tshuva, in other words. I teach it differently. Yoreh can be two different things. It says in the Torah by Hasinai that if you approach the mountain, you're going to be stoned or shot down. You know, a stone's going to flop on the guy, or he's going to be shot down to the ground. You know what it says? It says by the Mitzrim, Rama Vayam, Hashem pulled them up out of the ocean, and Yorah Vayam, he shot them down into the ocean. Yoreh is a lesson of shooting down. And if you know anything about physics, you know that when you shoot an arrow, you're really shooting it down. Whether you're shooting it up or not, it's always going down. So your physical, you know what I'm saying? So, all right, but that's another thing. So shooting down is the idea of Yorech HaTayim Baderech. He throws the sexaholic, the mistaker, faith is mistake, as Noach said. He throws the one who's mistaken, going on the wrong path, down hard onto the ground, until he's beaten into submission by his own actions. Tov v'yasher Hashem al kein yoreh chatzayim baderech. He knows that if God says, stop, stop, it's not going to work. We're not going to listen to God, sexaholics, alcoholics. We do not listen to God. It's still an outside force telling us to stop. And we do not stop under those circumstances. We just hide better, like by Adam. He's hiding from God. And he knew God pretty well, you know? We just try to hide, you know, sexaholics, alcoholics, etc. So what is it? So what is it? Hashem says, I'll throw you down hard onto the path until you finally do it for yourself, because you can't take it anymore. Through the pain of your own actions. So that's what he says about Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim, and so the people will know, ki hisalalti b'Mitzrayim. I made a fool out of Mitzrayim. How did he make a fool out of Mitzrayim? By them doing their own addiction. Paro was addicted to his Jews. It's clear. If you look at Paro, you find all the signs, perfect addict signs. He denies. And then when he says, okay, I'll let them go, please, just save me from this death. What does he do the next day? He says, no. It's okay. He sees kihar v'cha. He sees that it's okay, right? That's what it says in the pasuk. He's crazy about the frogs. He begs Moshe Rabbeinu to take them away. Moshe Rabbeinu prays and they go away. And Paro sees kihar v'cha, that now it's okay. Things are okay. You know, I got caught by my wife. Life was ending. It was horrible. I was embarrassed. I was dead meat. Eventually, she forgot about it a little bit. I saw it was okay, and eventually I started acting out again, you know? Getting caught by your wife never helps. It helps, but it never solves the problem itself. Your wife can't be your sponsor. Your wife can't keep you sober at all. So because it's still like God. It's an outside force. If God doesn't work, your wife sure as heck can't work. So to me, Paro is the addict, the perfect addict, quintessential addict. He's addicted to his Jews. And we're addicted to our drugs, you know. And Paro loses everything eventually. He's still melech for a long time, by the way, until eventually he loses everything. He loses his son, and he loses his own army. And then by the Ramban says so beautifully, by the end, in Parshas Beshalach, he says, how did Paro go into the Yamsuf? How could he have thought, the Ramban says, that Hashem split the Yamsuf for him? You know, he knew that he split the Yamsuf for the Jews, and yet he can go in and beat God using God's own weapon against God, that he's going to catch the Jews in the Yamsuf which God split for the Jews. He's going to, you know, the denial was so great, the blindness and the denial, the Ramban says, it just shows that he was a nut. That's what he said. The Ramban says that straight out. You see how crazy a person can be, you know, that's all. You know, he was nuts. So that's an addict. To me, that's the perfect addict. And what do we see? That Paro did tshuva as a result of that. He eventually became the king of Nineveh, according to at least one Medrash. And really led them to tshuva. A real tshuva, you know. Now, for him, it was a real tshuva. For them, it was only an external tshuva. So eventually, the city was destroyed. But for him, it was he really did tshuva. You know, at least as much as you know most people ever do. To me, that's the Nitzri story. And I sit through the whole Seder, and my eye is on Paro. He's my man. Paro is my man through the whole Seder because I relate to him perfectly. And everybody else does the story their way, and I do the story my way, you know, because I'm an addict. I'm sorry, that was a tangent. And that's just for me. You know, I'm not saying that that's the right thing for anybody else. So I said I want to get to 4, 5, 6, 7. The fourth step basically is four columns. That's how I like to do it personally. And the four columns I described to you are a little different than the four columns in the AA Big Book. The AA Big Book has four columns. I never quite understood what the column affects my. What does that mean? Affects my. And I just can't understand what those words are. Affects my pride. What does that mean? Affects my pride. I would love anyone to explain that to me. I can't seem to, the way you explain it has to be in completely different words so that now you're not explaining it anymore. You're restating it. So anyway, I don't do the four columns the way the AA Big Book does for this reason, but I do it in a way that gets to the spirit of it exactly and works beautifully for me one day at a time so far. And that is, the first column is my complaint. And people ask a lot, can God be in your complaint list? How can you possibly have a fourth step, you know, that includes a complaint on God? So, I mean, I asked this to my sponsor, and he said to me, he was a very religious man. He said to me, what do you mean? Like, is God real to you, or is God not real to you? If he's real to you, then you can be angry at him. If he's not real to you, then you can't be angry at him. You know, then he's just a figure, like a concept. You know, how dare we be angry at the Lord, you know? It's like, but if he's God, then he's like my father. You know, why is the Aseres HaDibros have Kabedes Avicha Vesimecha in the first half? You know, very strange. Why is Kabedes Avicha Vesimecha in the first half? Everyone knows, if you ask any kid, what's the difference in the first half of the Luchas and the second half of the Luchas? The first five are Ben Hash Adam Lamakom, between God, between man and God. The second five are between man and man, you know, mankind and mankind. So everyone knows that, you know. So then the question is, what's Kabedes Avicha Vesimecha doing there in number four, you know? I think it's number four. Or is that number five? Anyway, so what is it doing there? So to me, the answer is simple, that love of God and fear of God comes from kibud av v'em and mora em v'av. You know, fear of parents and love of kabed is all positive commandments. If you look in the halachas of kibud av v'em, all the halachas of kibud av v'em are positive things. Do this, feed them, clothe them, da-da-da-da-da. If you look at mora av v'em, fear of your parents, All the acts of fear are don't interrupt them, don't do this to them, don't hit them, don't no, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, don't contradict them. You know, don't sit in their seat. You know, so kibud av v'em is stand up when he comes in the room. Mora em v'av is don't sit in his chair. You know, you mekayem them both when you sit in his chair and then stand up when he comes in the room. But anyway, you shouldn't have been sitting there in the first place. But anyhow, so what is it doing in the first luchas? Hello, what? It's teaching us that our fear and love and fear of God, which, by the way, the Zohar Kodesh says, is love of God is all the positive mitzvahs. Fear of God is all the negative mitzvahs of the Torah. You know, and that's what kibud av v'em is exactly, positive and negative. You know. And that's love and fear. Kabed is really love. So it's showing love, demonstrating love, regard, you know. So love and fear of your parents is how you get a relationship with God, whether you like it or not. Your relationship with God, your understanding of God, is going to develop from how your parents treated you and how you interacted with your parents as a child. and that is inescapable human fact. Whether you become a Baal Tshuva or not, whether you become a whatever or not, your relationship with God at a very deep and real and simple level is going to be created when you're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old or younger even, and it's all from your relationship with your children, with your parents. And that's fine. That's not a problem. It's just a nice thing to know so that you can start looking at God and seeing, well, how could I be jerking off all day if I'm from? I believe in God. How could I be jerking off all day? Give up. Well, do you share everything with your parents? Do you see your parents as people to be avoided when you don't want them to know what you did? You just don't tell them, you know? How do you... You know, are you angry at your parents about anything? Did they punish you too much? Et cetera. You know, that's going to affect your relationship with God, and that's going to come out in therapy for many people or in step work for many people. Yism.
Could you maybe speak about educating children at one point?
Go for it. Oh, children? You mean with regards to sex education or
in
general?
No, in this regard. As a parent, what could I do, you know, to make sure my child has a good relationship with Hashem?
I see, right. Well, I would say, not being a child expert at all, but being a person who just experienced hell and heaven in child raising, I would say that if you want them to have a good relationship with Hashem, have a good relationship with your children. In other words, a healthy relationship where the love is obvious and clear to them, whether they might deny it and say, you hate me and I hate you, and then there's sometimes children who say that to you, you know, once in a while, love you, probably, because they're telling you a chiddush. They're saying, you know, they know that there's love, and then they see the worm has turned, you know, and they get all angry at you, and they say, you know, I don't love you right now, I hate you right now, you know, so don't, never be fazed by that. But rather, showing love to your children truly and honestly includes boundaries, giving them tools. You know, when your child has problems, instead of telling them what to do and or yelling at them or putting them down, giving them tools to overcome their problems or to deal with their problems makes a child feel confidence in his parents. Wow, I had a problem. I didn't know what to do. I went to my mother, and she told me, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I felt better, or the problem went away, or whatever, you know? Whether it's teaching them how to do business, whether it's teaching them how to deal with bullies, whether it's teaching them how to deal with feeling ashamed about something, you know, or whatever, you know? If you teach them a way and it actually works for them, they will get confidence in their parent and feel, oh, things are going to be okay because mommy and daddy are here, you know? Mommy and Tati know what to do, you know? And that's what little children need to get. If you're yelling at them all the time, they know in their heart right away that any parent who's constantly resorting to yelling simply doesn't know what to do. So they're resorting to brute force. I'm bigger than you, so I can force you to do this. They have no clue how to, like, you know, deal with situations. So they won't teach their kids tools. So the kids will not get confidence in their parents being a godlike figure, which a parent should be. You know? I'm like a suckling baby in your arms. That's how I am with you, God. In other words, my parents, you know? That's it. You know? I got it from my parents. David HaMelech knew how to depend fully on his parents. And therefore, you know, even though he had issues with his parents, obviously, some issues, you know, that they didn't really know who he was, I think. But all right, I'm not educated in the story, early story of David HaMelech, so I should keep my mouth shut. So anyway, so, you know, those are big things. You know, admitting when I don't know what to do, that I don't know what to do, is also part of what I teach my children, what I try to teach my children. You know, when I really don't know what to do, I say, you know what, I don't know what to do. I'm going to think about it, and I'm going to try to come up with something. And then what do? I quickly call somebody who I think, you know, hey, you know, Rebbe, what do I do, you know? You know, or I call my parents, you know, my mother, and I ask her, like, what do I do, you know? Or I look in a book on you know, child raising. One nice website that I found a lot of good aces with regards to tools for things like anger management and stuff like that is a great website called Celebrate Calm. And there's Jewish stuff called Love and Logic, you know, da, 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 da. Some people hold it, some people don't, whatever. But this thing called Celebrate Calm, C-A-L-M, calmness, you know, Celebrate Calm was a very big physic to me in dealing with anger management with my children and stuff. And because if my children are angry and I get angry back at them, I've taught them that I have no clue how to deal with feeling anger. And all I do is get angry at them. You know what I'm saying? So I got to do the star 8 thing again. Hang on. I see that it... Okay, fine. So that's... I don't want to get sidetracked too much, but that's one aspect of that thing. Giving my children tools includes when they're screaming and hollering at me, I don't scream and holler at them back because that's giving them zero tools in managing their anger. What's really going on in an interaction with me and my kids is not they're screaming at me about an issue and they want an answer to their problem. That's not really what's going on. What's really going on under the surface is they're finding an issue in life unmanageable and they're resorting to screaming, yelling, brute force, threats, etc. And they, because they have no clue what to do. And I have an opportunity now to teach them how to approach the situation in a calm way, at least. You know, so one thing in Celebrate Calm is that they teach you that to always use, when your kids are excited, upset, etc., yelling at you or arguing with you, is to use a calm posture. Sit down, never stand and talk to them because you're going to end up like going in their face and stuff. You're assuming a fighting posture. Get out of the fighting posture, sit down and lean back and look at them seriously, no smirking on the face, no sarcasm, just look at them calmly and take a calm physical posture, you know? That's one thing. The other thing is, well, whatever. I don't want to get too sidetracked, but that's suffice it to say, that's a big thing. And my own experience with my own children is that my firstborn son, Nebuch, had to suffer a great deal with a father who was, number one, a sexaholic and a fruitcake. And he had it rough. He really had it rough. He didn't know that part of the problem was him. He thought the problem was him, you know. He thought, I don't love him. And the fact is that when he was born, I was a sexaholic. I was an active sexaholic. What does your wife getting pregnant do to your sex life? You know, does it make it great because now she's materis all the time? Sure. You know, not so. Anybody who's had a wife and got married and had a child knows it doesn't do wonders for your sex life, getting pregnant, you know? That's one. Number two, having the child is a pain in the neck. Kids, all of a sudden, not me and her, you know, on a honeymoon anymore. It's me and her. And she's more interested in him than I am, than she is interested in me, you know? So it kind of gets you upset. Hard to deal with. Hard to deal with. So, and, you know, and she's tired all the time and this, and up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a crying baby and this, you know? Why do you think there's more acts of violence against babies by men who shake them and never kill them because shaking a baby's head causes permanent neck and brain damage? Why do you think that it happens mostly with men, more often with men than women, if women are more often holding the baby? It's because men are angry that this child is interfering in their time with their woman, you know? So this boy Nebuch had a father who wanted to be good but didn't know how because he was too angry at this invader taking away his, you know, my wife's breasts changed from beautiful, pretty things that I liked into a milk factory that was at work, you know? It was working. This is serious business. It's not fun anymore. She changed my wife's body into something that was always tired, you know? It all very upsetting to me, you know? In the big picture, I came to see that in sobriety later on, you know, after 2-3 years. And our relationship didn't get better until I was sober for about 3 or 4 years, you know, my son and I. My second son, who's much younger, I have come to see in recovery that that when I'm around my first son, who suffered at my hands terribly, and I'm nice to this boy, because I've already done an eighth and ninth step amends with my oldest son. I've done direct amends, you know, which I'll just use an example is in this case is walking over to my son after doing steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 regarding my frustrations with this boy and how I dealt with them and what character defects it demonstrates I clearly have, admitting that to another person, my sponsor, and then seeing in 6, am I ready to let it go or do I need to hang on to it and still assert myself and let him know how angry I am, et cetera. You know, so after I do that, what I've come to see is that by being patient and showing love properly with his younger brother, what I'm doing is I'm saying to this child, it was never about you all along. It was always about me. I've developed and I've made amends with you, and I'm trying not to do the things to him that I did to you. You know? So you know it's not about you. It's about me. I was the problem, not you, back then. You know? And it's leading to healing for him as a result, which he could never have gotten any other way, I think. Another tremendous thing that happened in recovery was I insisted after a few years that to my wife that I needed to go to therapy to learn how to relate to this child, the first one. And she didn't like the idea, so I went. And the therapist eventually schlepped her in. And the one thing the therapist taught us was this. This boy is playing the two of you like a violin. He plays one against the other. The two of you have to get onto the same page. Okay? I had always been terrified of being on the same page with my wife because, as an addict, I had basically a one-track mind, you know, or maybe two-track mind. My wife was always never religious enough for me, never firm enough and spiritual enough for me, you know, and also never sexual enough for me. Those were the two things that I was always, you know. So that kind of put a damper on our relationship quite a bit. And I always felt the lack of confidence. I felt in myself, I have nothing really of any great value to say. So why would I open up to her about what I think about this furniture and what I think about what school to send our son to or our daughter to and what to do with this and what to do with that? Why would I want to get into the deep conversations with her about real life stuff if I felt like I really had nothing to say? And anyway, if I say something that's going to displease her, then she's not going to want to have sex with me tonight. You know? I saw that that's the way my brain was working in recovery. You know, let me not say that it's all about sex. She's not going to admire me, you know, which eventually trickles down to lack of sex. But, it's a fear, a lot of fear. So what did this therapist do? This therapist, as a result of me having tremendous conflict with this boy and because of recovery, coming to see that I cannot have this anymore, I need to take responsibility. That's what recovery is all about. Recovery is about taking responsibility for yourself and your life and taking the steps that are really necessary, going to a meeting, getting a sponsor, working the steps, not just talking about them. Work it. Write it on paper. Work it. Share it. Do it. You know? So make it real and do it. You know, that's what recovery is about. AA never would have started if Dr. Bill and Dr. Bob were corresponding by mail or something, you know. These were two men, two grown men who got together in a room and looked at each other and said, we see ourselves as babies and we're really men. We treat our wives like they're in charge of us and we escape with alcohol, you know, and stuff like that, you know, admitting the truth to each other, eye to eye, and realizing that, hey, he feels the same way I do about his own things in his own way. I really am a person, a real person, you know. Maybe God really does have patience for me, you know, because he's having patience for him, you know. And he's sober now, so he's obviously helping him out, too. Maybe he can help me, too, and bring me to sanity, you know. Anyhow, they knew that alcohol is a power greater than themselves that restores them to insanity. But they came to believe now that there is another power greater than themselves that restores them to sanity, you know, and they call it God, you know, for lack of a better word. So, and that's why a lot of from guys come to the program, they stop saying Hashem and Rabbanu Shalom when they're speaking program and they talk about God. And it's weird seeing a Chassidish guy with a thick accent from Monroe, you know, talking about their Eberster and their Rabbanu Shalom and this and that, and he comes in the meeting and he's talking with his wife and he's talking with me and he talks about God, God, you know? But weird, but he's transforming his understanding of God from the Hashem of his youth, which really comes together with a whole lot of crappy baggage, to God, you know? And it's he's rebuilding his relationship with the Rabbanu Shalom on a new footing, you know, on a new understanding, a new peace, you know? And he has to use different terminology as a result, you know? And it's fine. Works out fine. Most cases, you know? There can be rocky parts, which we can talk about on another call, but in general, it works out fine. So, again, back to where I was. So, the therapist told us that you and your wife are on two separate pages, and this child knows it and plays you against her and her against you all the time. It's time that the two of you started talking, because you're not talking, and discussing what's going on with this child. When there's a conflict that comes up, you and her have to get in complete and total agreement. Doesn't mean you have to really agree, but you have to agree on a plan that both of you are going to stick to. You know, you can't have two different ideas and ways of dealing with him. I always want to give in, and she always wants to fight him. You know, because I hate conflict, and she hates him doing things that she doesn't like him to do. You know, more than she hates conflict. So with the two of us, we're very different with this child. He knew it, so he played the two of us against each other. And finally, we started going on walks and talking about different situations and what to do. And I discovered an amazing thing, that I have an opinion, you know, that I have what to say. Couldn't believe it. I had no clue, you know. And she listens to me and discusses, and there's a lot to this woman, and there's a lot to me that she brings out when we discuss stuff together. That was a slow process, you know? And that was amazing. And that transformed our marriage. That in itself transformed our marriage completely. And we still go on walks today. As soon as the weather is warm, the two of us look at each other and we go, finally, we can go on walks again, because she hates going outside in the cold, you know? So, and every now and then she'll say, I have to go on a walk tonight. You know, if let's say my wife goes to the mikveh and she wants to be sexual that night, you know, which she doesn't have to be, but if she, you know, she wants to. So she wants to be able to because she believes it's the right thing. So she'll say to me very often on mikveh night, she'll say to me, Dov, I have to go on a walk with you. No, night. Because she knows the only way she's going to connect is if we go on a walk together and talk. And there's something special about going on a walk together that's better than sitting at a table and staring at each other and trying to figure out things and talk things, you know? We need a little distraction because it's a little too intense, you know, otherwise. And instead of saying, wait, that's not a good sign, that's the way it is, you know. Now we can sit at a table a lot, and we do, but the walking has been a transformational experience, and it all came because of conflict with this boy. But he saved our marriage, I think. And so it's funny how things go around, you know. So again, back to step four. Step four, complaint against situation. You know, my mother-in-law, she always interrupts me and makes fun of me, and I, you know, column two, exactly what is she doing? Exactly what? Write it out exactly in detail. This is the way the AA Big Book does it. Exactly what in detail is that person doing that gets so under your skin? You know, well, she says this and that and asks questions about and complains about things that I do and it, you know, whatever. And that gets me so angry, you know, it gets me so upset. Column three, what do you want to do as a result of her behavior, you know? She said to your, you know, I can't come up with a specific thing right now, but she said something specific to my wife that criticized something that I did, you know? So it's like so upsetting, you know. So that's column two. Column three. Column three is, how does it make me feel? What does it make me feel like doing as a result? So, you know, I want to yell at her. You know, I want to yell at her. Okay, so that's clearly anger. That's clearly anger. So what am I feeling? Anger. I'm feeling resentment. Anger. Okay, well, what, column four, what is my character defect? What is the matter with me that I'm responding in that way? Because guess what? Why is she doing this? Is she doing this because she's the evil witch of the West? Nobody's really the evil witch of the West. As you and I know, we do things because of a reason. That's the way people are. We do things because that's the way we were treated, so that's how we treat other people. We do things because we're trying to build ourselves up, because that's what we want to do. She's doing this to me either because she doesn't even recognize that she's doing it. That's one possibility. The other possibility is because she's trying to protect her daughter, which is usually the reason. Because she has in her mind that I'm no good, you know, the way you expect her to do. What do you really expect her to do? What am I going to, if I yell at her and scream at her, then I'm going to convince her that I am good? You know? How am I going to convince her that I'm good? You know, if that's the problem, you know, with this anger and this resentment, how is that going to help me solve this problem? You know, it's not. I have a character defect. This anger, what is that from? What does that say about me? That's the main part of the fourth column is, I react in this way with anger. What does that say about me? That I'm getting angry at a woman who's simply trying to protect her daughter in her own goofy way. She's a little crazy, she's wrong, this and that, but she's really trying to protect her daughter. Why do I get angry at a woman who's trying to protect, a parent who's trying to protect her child, exactly? That frames it a little different, doesn't it? Column four is where I answer the question, what is the matter with me that she drives me crazy when she tries to protect her daughter? And the answer is very simple. My pride. It hurts my pride. You know, I can't be put down in front of my wife. It hurts my pride. You know, so I'm hurt because I have gaiva, that I am proud. You know, that's the problem. Okay, so the problem here is not her behavior, but mine, my attitude. I have pride in me that says no one can say anything. Now, does my wife agree with her 100%? Who says? Probably not. But she's certainly going to agree with her 100% if I scream and yell. So what have I done by accepting responsibility on myself for the bad way I feel in this situation and saying it's my fault that I feel this badly, instead of putting the blame on her, which is everything, which is all I've been doing until now? What have I done? What damage have I done? None. Okay? So now I can say, well, my problem is pride. Step five, admit it to somebody. Okay. Step six, became, would anybody have the lesson there? Became completely willing to have God remove these defects of character. You know, that's the basic lesson. So how do I become completely willing to have God remove my pride? Gewalt, what am I going to do without my pride? How do I protect myself? That's the problem. How do I protect myself, you know, against people? Whenever anybody says anything, my pride has to come in to say, hey, I'm the father here. How dare you? No. You know, when my children don't listen and I freak out, what does that say about me? Well, my pride is being injured. Oh, and it's a mitzvah. Keep it up and aim. Hoy! You know? That's twisting the Torah. That's abuse of the Torah. It's Torah abuse, you know? You apologize to the Torah for doing that. Apologize to Hashem for doing that. Really, it's just my pride being hurt. You know, how dare you not listen to me and what I want? What? What I want means that everybody should say, yes, sir. You know, everybody has to agree with everything I want and has to, like, see my way of seeing things. Can't be. That's pride. That's gaiva. What am I, God? Excuse me? Am I God? You know? So I become willing. Am I willing to have God remove this pride? Or am I going to hang on to it because I feel like, my God, how am I going to survive without it? how am I going to survive without it? You know? Same as the alcoholic or the sexaholic surrendering his alcohol or his sex and lust. He says, like the guy texted me today, how am I going to survive without it? I can't imagine life without it. So he's never going to surrender it as long as he feels like, since I can't imagine life without it, I better not let it go. I better hang on to it. He's never going to get free. You know, there has to be a willingness, not just a leap of faith. This is a willingness. It's a willingness to let go of my pride and say, you know, my pride is actually my enemy here. It's really just distorting our relationship because my mother-in-law does not have to respect me by agreeing with everything I do. Ah, does she have to contradict me in front of my children? No. I can tell her, Schwieger, I don't like it when you contradict me in front of my children. No? So could you please not do that? I could say that to her. That's not the problem here. The problem is that I'm getting angry about it, and I'm yelling at her, or I'm not yelling at her, and it's cooking in me, and it's driving me crazy. That's the problem. Communicating, that's not the problem. I'm not communicating. You know, I'm just cooking. I'm getting angry, or I'm yelling. That's not communicating. Yelling isn't communicating. Yelling is increasing my pride triple fold and saying, oh, yeah, you know, you're injuring my pride. And I'll show you how, what happens to people who injure my pride. You know, they get embarrassed, you know, in front of their own daughter and get called names and this and that. Can you imagine? That's my character defect of pride. That's what it does, you know. That's what it does. My boss puts me down by saying, you're not doing this, you're not doing that. My reaction is, in my heart, I want to say, oh, yeah, well, you're a crappy boss, you know. Look at this that I did and that I did and you didn't appreciate it and I'm not complaining. So he or she is the boss, not me, you know. I'm working for them. They're not working for me. I'm not here to tell them how to be bosses, right? I'm here to work for their satisfaction, you know. Now, if they're being unfair to me, I can communicate that, you know. Based on this, I think that you could treat me a different way. I'd like it if you treated me a different way, but that's not anger. That's not coming from anger. That's coming from a decision. I will not be, you know, abused in this way anymore. That's what I'm saying inside. And now I say to them, I want you to, instead of doing this, I want you to do that, please. That's what I'd like. And you can have a discussion. But it doesn't work when I'm angry and want to scream at them. Right? It doesn't work. What comes out of my mouth is, So my problems are of my own making. You know? Because I'm trying to manage the show. And that's what the AA Bill writes in the big book. The problem is that we try to manage the show. So the fourth step, the four columns, and the last column is the ichor, which comes out of the third column, is that it, excuse me a second. Yes, dear. Hi, sweetheart. Oh, okay, Trev. All right. That son needs me to take him somewhere right now. So I'm going to go. But while I'm getting, you know, ready, the fourth step gives us finally the ability to take responsibility for our own problems and see how they are. The emotional issue that I'm having is a problem created by me and my character defect, colliding with God's will. In other words, life, such as it is, people, life, that's God's will. God's will for me is that I have a mother-in-law who treats me this way. That's God's will for me, you know? And I don't like it. My will is colliding with his will, ultimately. So it's an acceptance, step four is an acceptance that I'm the problem here. My feelings are the problem because they're based on attitudes that I have, beliefs that I have, that people ought to really listen to everything I say, for example. That's pride. And for that reason, the solution is not working on my pride. The solution is like what that man said about his children, Nebuch. Complete and utter surrender. That's it. There is no other answer. And that's step seven. Step six, I agree that I can't have it anymore. Step seven, I say, I say that I'm ready to live without it, and step six. And step seven, because I know I am, that's step six. Step six is very hard to do. Very, very hard. A very tall order. Step six, true willingness to go without it, you know, letting it go. Very, very tall order. We need help for that. And including davening and sharing and stuff like that. And step seven is humbly asking him to remove these shortcomings. And Chuck C. once asked Bill W., you know, he said to him, people do drushes about shortcomings in the seventh step, wrongs, the exact nature of our wrongs in the fifth step. Fourth step says our defects of, sixth step says our defects of character. Fourth step is moral inventory. They're all different terms. And why do they each mean something else? Because there are umpteen drushes on this in AA literature written by well-meaning addicts. And Bill answered, laughed, and he said, no, they're all exactly the same thing, and they're saying, and they're talking about exactly the same issue. Just that I didn't want to use the same word three times in a row, you know, three, four times in a row, because of proper English. That's all. But it's all the same thing. So, and that's 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, God willing, next time we'll talk. I'm going to go now. God willing, next time we'll talk about, you know, 8 and 9 I talked about enough already here, but I'll talk about them briefly. There's not much to say, thank God. And 10 is a continuation of 8 and 9, so there's not much there. And we'll talk a little bit about step 11 next time, and then I want to do question and answer stuff. And if people have, you know, more questions about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then, you know, they can do that too. I'm signing off, okay? I'm going to stop the recording now.